Yeah! Here we go. Tom and Curly Show. Thank you, everybody. Hey, special thanks to Bucky's. Bucky's Auto Service Centers. As you know, they have got 16 locations. Every one of them is terrific. And they've been around for 50 years. And that is the place to take your car. Because you can trust them at Bucky's. Pull in there and just say, hey, my car, something's wrong. Please help me. Here's my credit card. Here's a big bag of cash. Just take what you need. Fix it, please. I trust you. Implicitly. Big bag of cash. Roll into Bucky's with a big bag of cash. All right, it's big bag of cash day tomorrow, I think, at Bucky's, Tom.
Okay,
you won't even I'll take need a your big word bag. For it. Small bag. Just say, here, guys, take what you need. Dive in and no! Remember when I was traveling for Evening Magazine, I forget what country I was in, I couldn't figure out the money. You know, like, I don't know, how much is it? And you just hold out like a big pile of these. They look like cartoons of people, you know, and you're like, here, just take what you need. Here, what? How much does that cost? And you see the person look at you, and they're slowly like picking through your pile of papers that you don't quite get.
But I think most of them were honest because they realized that they would be taking advantage. It'd be like taking candy from a kid.
Yes.
It's not fair, so they actually are honest.
They were
you assume
honest.
They're honest?
I assume. I don't know. It didn't mean anything to me. Here comes Sully.
Perfect.
All right. Come on, Sully, get in here.
Hey, speaking of taking what you need, yeah. You know, you want to give me a little something that you owe me?
Oh, by the way, I think of you all the time. When I get on I-5, here's the quick story is that they were supposed to close the lane down, take the lane away, because they didn't want to confuse people. Remember this? This is at the Fed, right? They didn't want to confuse people, so they were going to start. They're going to take it away now before they begin construction. And I said, this is the stupidest thing. And then I said to Sully, I'll give you $3,000 if you get him to open that lane back up again. And Sully makes one phone call, which is nothing, really, when you think about it. Certainly not worth $3,000.
It was $5,000, by the way.
Well, the way the dollar and the mortgage rate's incredibly low with Keel Mortgage.
Pre-pandemic dollars.
They opened up this lane. They still haven't done the construction, have they, Sully?
No, they have not. Just give me what I need.
I will. I'll give it to
you. You still have a bag of cash.
I'll give it to you in bot or whatever that monetary exchange was.
Bitcoin.
Bitcoin. All right. So, hey, are people really moving back to the suburbs?
You know, this is a very interesting discussion that kind of grew out of this conversation yesterday with a well-known Northwest traffic engineer, Mark Hollenbeck, at the University of Washington. We were discussing, or actually they're talking about how much money the Department of Transportation is losing or not taking in over their forecasts based on the lack of tax revenues. And he was wondering if that now combination of working from home, whatever that turns out to look like long term, a couple days a week at the office or at home all the time, whatever, if that will mean that people will now get away from the urban centers because you don't have to go to them anymore, and you can go to that distance away and afford the house, get the big yard. Because in the past, the trade-off used to be you'd have to go way out, but then you'd get stuck in traffic, and that was the trade-off. And if there is no traffic anymore, because as we've seen, we're still down 50% on a lot of the roads, it's an interesting discussion going forward is, has all the last 20 years of urban planning now set on its head? Because now people can work from home, and they no longer have to worry about that commute, and then they could still get more home the further out that they go.
Do we know, though, Chris, how many people want to work from home? Just because you can doesn't mean that might be the ideal. We are still in a somewhat of a shutdown economy right now. I think that to assume that none of us are going to get back in our cars and drive to work, or, you know, that not that many more people than are right now, seems like a desperate guess.
Well, at this point, and that was kind of the point of this exercise, is the fact that the state really can't forecast right now because
right.
It doesn't know what our human behavior is going to be. So Mark Hollenbeck, as a traffic engineer, was kind of waxing poetic and going, geez, I'm really fascinated in what we are going to do, we collectively as the public, and will this mean a return to this? He's not predicting that, mm-hmm. But I thought it was a okay. very interesting
yeah.
discussion of some point of, wow, are we at that kind of a point? Because we don't know. We don't know what working from home will be. And he kind of prefaced it on of, well, if we get a vaccine for COVID and people believe in the next 18 months, maybe this will mm-hmm. just be a little blip. If it's four
right.
years, maybe this is a more longer term thing. So it was kind of an interesting look at, wow, what could happen downrange from somebody who really looks at this stuff. And I found it kind of fascinating just as a topic of discussion, not necessarily a blueprint of where we are going. But I found it fascinating.
Well, don't you think it was always the case that you could work from home and get the work done once you had the internet and once people were like, why do I need to come in here? Right. If I can get it done from home, why am I getting in the car, driving all the way in, spending all that time in the car, listening to Dave Ross and Colleen O'Brien on Cairo Radio? And then
that's reason enough to commute.
I know.
And Tom, listening to you guys on the way home. Let's
I know.
Forget.
This is ask not who the bell tolls. It tolls for us, Tom, because nobody's got to be. No one's in the car.
Get back in your darn cars.
No, honestly, if people are not driving and they're not commuting in, that's why they were stuck in their cars. They have nothing else to do but listen to us. So this is very bad for us. And I will encourage everybody, what is happening at work? You're not there. You know what they're doing? They're thinking of getting rid of you. And you need to get in there immediately.
In talking about this, and this discussion was happening before the Washington State Transportation Commission, as they were kind of trying to look at the effects of COVID on transportation dollars and, you know, what we have to do with toll rates and things like that. But, and so that was why it was kind of interesting. But what they found, or what people are getting, is from the tech companies specifically, is that the downside of staying away from each other is they're losing kind of the spark of ingenuity. When you had someone from, say, Microsoft get out of their South Lake Union office and walk down and meet somebody who works at another, you know, giant like that, and they had lunch and they talked about something, they came back to their own offices with, like, maybe five new ideas. And so the creative process some of these companies are going is kind of lost with that face-to-face not happening. So there's a concern about that as well. And, you know, maybe when you go forward, these teams get together once a week. And each team gets together on a different day, so, you know, we can still do social distancing. But I also found it fascinating that these people who can, by design, working on computers or thinking of things like this, they've kind of lost that creative spark because they're not there sharing details, whether having a coffee or sharing a beer after work or things like that. I found that also kind of an interesting component as well.
They also save money. This is Global Workplace Analytics, a piece from NPR. It says that the typical employer can save up to $11,000 a year for every person who works remotely half of the time.
Wow. I mean, there are cost savings to be had, but then on the downside of that, if you look downstream to another industry, what is that going to do to real estate? You know, what are the prices per square foot in the buildings downtown if no one really needs to come in? Again, which kind of leads us to what is this, you know, what is the real impacts of this if our downtowns become ghost towns because everyone is working on their 10-acre ranch out in the middle of Sultan, which sounds pretty good someday. You know, sit out there on your deck with great Wi-Fi and do the work that you need to do. Why not?
Can we get back to what's happening to talk radio in the afternoon? Isn't that more important, gentlemen? Huh?
Well, of course. The thing is most creative sparking happens while listening to the Tom and Curly Show.
Right.
That's right. So we're the substitute for going into work. You just have to listen to us. We're all good.
Yeah.
Hey,
good.
Chris, I would like to direct your attention to, again, this is from your own article. By 2023, the losses projected by the DOT are just under $700 million. What does that do to all of our transportation plans that, you know, are now out into like till 2040? A $700 million loss. How are we going to cope?
It's a great question, and they don't know. Because, and again, this $700 million, when you think of it, it's less money than they were, $700 million less than they were anticipating. It's not like they're actually losing $700 million out of the checking account. They were expecting to have $700 more, but they're not getting it. I mean, because it's interesting. I mean, you look at the 4 months from February to May. At the gas pump alone, more than $100 million in lost gas tax revenue. Because people are not out. And that, what does that fund? That funds roads and maintenance projects and things like that. You can't get that money back, at least not in the short term. Ferries is losing $10 million a month in revenue that they expected because ridership is off so much. They're losing $110 million, well, $107 million, I think, in tolling. Over the next biennium because, you know, the lack of cars out there, they aren't using the toll lanes as much. I don't know how they're going to recoup this money. I don't know why they haven't decided to get some sort of special session together down in Olympia to talk about these real dollars and cents, because it's not just DOT. I mean, Metro's losing $480 million or $460 million. Sound Transit is losing hundreds of millions of dollars over their predictions over the because of lost sales tax revenue. So, yeah, I mean, these are legit issues that I really honestly believe it's time for Olympia to get together and start talking about this.
Yeah.
A special session, I think, is almost, it has to happen.
By the way, you will only hear all of those numbers on talk radio on the way home on talk radio. Bring it all the way around. So,
and we didn't, even get to ask him about Metro cutbacks.
I know, Tom. That's why I did that intentionally. I pressed that.
Why don't you ask a transit driver what they think of what's happening right now with Dow Constantine trying to take away their new contract? Mm. That sounds pretty interesting, doesn't it?
Dicey.
Thanks, Ellie. Say anything else? You just laughed. Sorry,
Sully. Oh, I potted him down.
Oh, you potted Sean down. Cut me.
Goodbye.
Yeah, Sean,
sorry.
Cut me.
It was much cleaner. It was much cleaner. I shouldn't have questioned.
Grab the hook.
Get him out of here. All right, stop it. Stop the. Bring the music down. Supreme Court lets the employers out of having to provide birth control. So it was an Obamacare passes, and then everybody votes on it. It barely squeaks through. It goes through. And then near the, I think they slipped this thing in there. HHS put in there that it's a mandate that employers must provide birth control. So then all of a sudden you had religious groups. There was, hey, I'm an employer, a Catholic school, or I'm in Little Sisters of the Poor. We don't want to provide birth control. It goes against what we believe. And it's been fought. Finally, when the Supreme Court kicked it up at, I think, 8-0, they basically said, you know, we're going to kick it back to the states. They throw it back to the other courts. And then I looked like it was about to go through. And then some different, I guess, AGs in various states across the United States, most of them are Democrats, said, no, we're going to challenge this. So they challenge it again. So it goes back before the Supreme Court. They finally take a look at it. And how do they rule, Tom?
Yeah, your side, John, if you and I have different sides when it comes to Supreme Court decisions, this one, you won.
Oh.
Maybe the transgender thing was a bone to the liberals. This is more of a bone to the conservatives. And they said that, yes, it's within the Trump administration's abilities. That's the dispute, not whether you should or shouldn't, but that the Trump administration, unlike the Obama administration, the Trump administration wanted to do this, which said that if your employer has some kind of religious objections, and it needn't be that, you know, like they use the Sisters of the Poor, as the main argument for that, but this applies to all employers. If you have an employer who has personal objections to birth control, mm-hmm. which I mean, this isn't just an objection to abortion, but hasn't literally an objection to birth control, which is wildly popular even among Catholics, birth control. But if an employer says that he has a religious objection to that, the Supreme Court ruled that they don't have to decide that. I mean, that they don't have to pay that. Under the Obama administration, they would have. And what I'm wondering is this now going to be like back and forth between whichever administration is in? Can they, you know, if a Biden administration goes back, can they say, okay, no, under ours, or if this is going to have some kind of precedent setting that you can never restrict? Because at this point, they just ruled that the Trump administration had the right to go ahead and do this if they wanted to.
Right, because they should have ruled on the fact that the government is compelling thought. And it can't do that. And the protection under the First Amendment would say that, no, I can't be compelled to do something that I am morally against, as the Little Sisters of the Poor. And the fact that the Supreme Court should then kick it back to the federal government has no right to mandate that you have to provide this service. If you want, just have the states decide on it. The states want to do it, let the states do it. Let each one of the states determine whether or not the states will provide birth control for the citizens. Don't make the employer do it if the employer has some problem with it. So they ruled on the fact, does the president have the power to do this? The answer is yes. Did Obama have the power to mandate? The answer was yes on that as well. But by the way, it was not in Obamacare. In the original piece that they voted on, I know they voted on it, and then they had to go back and read it, as Nancy Pelosi said. It was added in later on by HHS.
Yeah. And the argument that the Supreme Court used was that there's a 1993 Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Yes.
And what the argument there said was that the government must have a compelling reason for programs that substantially burden religious beliefs. Mm-hmm. And so the argument from the left was that, that the compelling reason was that women need this, or a lot of women that need this, and so you would be burdening anybody who worked for an organization, even if they had nothing to do with the actual business. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you work for a convent. If you're a nun in a convent, I don't think that they're going to be concerned about birth control. But, you know, you were Hobby Lobby. We had that ruling a few years earlier that there's nothing necessarily religious about Hobby Lobby, the activity of the business. But because the owner was, I don't know if he's a strict Catholic or whatever he is, had religious objections, they could say that. In this particular case, they said, yes, that was that the argument in defense of women and should have access to contraceptive care wasn't a compelling enough reason to reject someone's religious beliefs for not wanting to do that.
Mm-hmm. I bet it does come back around again, and they left the hole open. But then say that the state then provides it. The state basically provides it now, that if you want to get free birth control, you can head to Planned Parenthood, and some type of program will provide it for you. The Little Sisters of the Poor. The nice thing is the Obama administration stopped fining them tens of thousands of dollars because it's right there in their name, poor. Little Sisters of the Poor.
They could use that money. No, and one of the silver lining for liberals, the Trump administration, this is Kayleigh McEnany, actually said that women who lack access to contraceptive coverage because of their employer's religious beliefs, who are now impacted, or moral convictions, to more easily access such care through federal programs. So the Trump administration, for the next 4 months at least, is committed to trying to find federal programs that will allow for that, that doesn't abuse the religious beliefs of the owners of the companies that don't have to provide it.
Why is the federal government providing birth control? All right, right back. I downloaded new Tom Waits, or old Tom Waits, and man, that music is not for everybody. I gotta warn you. Play that for friends, and like, what is he doing?
Really? Even the early stuff?
Well, no, I don't like the early stuff. Compared to the new stuff, the older stuff, he's in
broken bicycle.
The piano has been drinking, not me.
Oh my God, that's greatest.
Well, we just alienated and lost 99.9% of everybody. All right, write to us at mynorthwest.com. Tell us how much you love Tom Waits. You can also text as well. Come on through the state roofing text line at 989073. Thank you, everybody. By the way, it was Harper's Magazine. This guy that writes for Harper's said, you know what? I get a sense that we got to watch out because it seems like we're losing a lot of tolerance. We can't express opinions and ideas. People really seem to be on edge, and we need to do something about it. So there's a pushback saying, hey, everybody, I understand that people are concerned, but let's be able to have dialogue. Let's be able to express opinions that may vary from, something else somebody might believe. But if we're not able to do that, if we can't have this free exchange, not only for authors and writers and editors and artists, what are we doing? This is not a good direction we're heading in. So the guy writes the piece, and then a whole bunch of people, I mean, a who's who of who's who's, signs up and says, yeah, I agree with all of this. Tom, you were impressed by the number of people that had signed the letter saying, yeah, this seems to make sense.
Yes, and the first thing you do is you go, I mean, because the letter is very well written, it's very well composed, and you look to see who signed on to it, because a lot of times these letters are not just what they say, they're about their positioning politically and what their response to something that's happening in the culture, and you want to see, you kind of get a gauge. And what I was impressed about, all the people that signed on, and they're mostly, you know, like artists and intellectuals, but they found conservatives and they found liberals. They found, you know, white, Anglo-Saxon Protestants, I'm assuming a lot of these people are, but they also found Muslims and Jews and, you know, Catholics. I mean, it is a fine array of some of the best that intelligentsia has to offer, covering all forms.
Yeah.
But the thing is, Harper's is smart, and the guy who put this together is smart. They know what they're doing because they realize this is a really touchy subject matter right now. And when we do this, we are going to get a reaction. Get this, that letter that we're talking about now, it's going to be appearing in the October issue. Mm. October. Okay, so we are 5 months out, 4 or 5 months out. But they decide to make it public now because they wanted to get reaction to it. They figured that this would be, you know, this is going to be a powerful statement. A lot of people will react. And almost immediately, there's a follow-up in the New York Times saying, yeah, artists and writers warn of intolerant climate, reaction is swift. And there's been a lot of pushback on that. And so I think that we both come, I think, come from a school where, you know, you have sort of civil discourse. You have one side, another side, a third side, a fourth side, but everyone just sort of throws out their opinions, and that's that. And as we are now dealing with a president, I think that we're not used to, we as a country are not used to, there are a lot of people that, that are thinking, I wonder if this civil discourse isn't enough. When you have somebody like a Donald Trump who is, he's intentionally outrageous and overstates things, that maybe his illiberalism is what they call it, needs a stronger response. And that's what I think the debate is really about, is like, do you allow for, and again, I you take some, let's like Trump out of it because he's politically too potent and toxic at the same time for discussion, but take some political figure who is successful, but you see him as a danger in his success, that it's not balanced or it's not legitimate in any kind of a democratic way. If you feel that, is just raising your hand very politely saying, I think that this person is understating or overstating the problem and is directing us. Is that a proper enough way to go about it? Or should you take this moment as the culmination of all of your frustrations over decades or hundreds of years for that matter, and use that against the people that are in the way of what you think is the right way to go?
Well, here's the way I look at it. First, there's no conservatives or very few on the list because they take a shot at Trump at the very beginning and say the problem is Trump has caused us to do this. This is the cancel culture that has now started to cancel liberals. So liberals are now starting to realize, oh, my gosh, hey, look at this. They're coming after us. The revolutionaries always eventually end up destroying their enablers. So that is what has happened. So the people that are on the left with the left ideas now start to say, hey, everybody, this has gone too far. This cancel culture stuff that's going on is completely closing down dialogue. We can't say anything. Look at the people from the New York Times that were forced out, and they were liberals, but they unfortunately wrote a piece. Tom Cotton let Tom Cotton do a piece about maybe the military should go in, and Tom Cotton's piece was well-researched, and it was more than 6 hours or 4 hours back and forth with the New York Times until finally they got all the stuff straightened out, and they said, okay, we're going to print it. Well, it was so, the people that write for the Times, so outraged. They demanded someone's head, and the op-ed editorialist has to go. The same thing with the Philadelphia Inquirer has to go. The fact that Splash Mountain has now had to change its name, and it has to redo itself. The number,
well,
the list of
people. All to the good.
It's all good. The part about
the Splash Mountain business, I don't have a problem with that. Do you?
I
mean, there are some good things that are happening. The Confederate statue's coming down. I think that's probably a good thing, don't you?
No, I don't. I don't.
Oh, you
think
don't?
That, no,
oh,
I don't
wow.
think you
okay.
take down Confederate statues. I think what you do is you put everything in context. But because where does it stop, right? Where do we end up saying?
Well, and that's because, where we're. That's the argument.
And
right
that's
now,
where this letter is. Because now, all of a sudden, the liberals are like, whoa, they're coming for us. They don't come for us. And then here's the backsplash of the whole thing. The people that have signed the letter are now like, I wouldn't have signed that if those guys had signed it. I don't want to be associated with those other people, right? So they're trying to back away from it. Somebody expresses a point
of
view.
Just a couple of them.
Yeah, enough that they give themselves some cover. You express a point of view, then it's not part of the orthodoxy, so you're going to have to be fired and destroyed. So this is what happens. It is. I mean, I'm reading about Mao's Red Guard. It's the same thing. But he encouraged all those kids to go out and get rid of the, what was it, the five evils or the four terribles or whatever it was, the culture and the other things they needed to get rid of. This is what's happening now. So here we go. You get a chance to read a letter from a bunch of liberals that are now concerned that the cancel culture is coming after them.
So who are you more mad at? The people
I'm
that
not
wrote
mad at anybody.
The initial level? Well, or
no,
whatever,
I'm not mad.
Disagree
I'm
with.
I'm sad.
The people that
sad.
Wrote the initial letter or the people that are now responding and thinking it's fatuous and full of privilege?
Well, of course you have to use the word privilege because that's what you say when somebody says something. that you disagree with, you immediately want to cut them down and stop them from having an opinion.
Well, I think it's a legitimate notion, this idea of privilege. Are we in a position of privilege? I remember there's this great scene in the autobiography of Simone de Beauvoir where she is out as a, she's a, you know, a radical. I can't remember now if she's a socialist, but she was arguing a really strong left-wing line in France, and she was dealing with a bunch of poor people, and they were talking about, you know, you are allowed that kind of philosophical level. We are trying to, you know, figure out a way to eat and to home ourselves. We don't have time for your philosophical arguments about freedom this and freedom that. And it was like, it was a real comeuppance to her. And she realized, yeah, that it is a privilege to be able to make these philosophical and political arguments when you're not worried about, you know, basically feeding yourselves. And there's that kind of division. I think privilege, it needn't be a left or right idea. We, some of us are more privileged than others given the comfort of our situation. That's all that is.
Well, everybody should have the privilege to express a point of view without fear that by saying something that is not in step with the orthodoxy,
yes,
that you lose your job. Is there, but what, do we really, the First Amendment, it's the first one, it's not the fifth. It's the one they put in place first, which is you have to be able to have an open society where you can express a point of view. If not, you end up with what happened in France, you end up what happens in China, and you end up what happens in North Korea, where you or in Russia, where you can't express an idea
States.
Because if you express an idea, they come and get you, right?
I know it. And yet, if you're an African American, you've never had that right. So for hundreds of years,
never had the right to Thomas Sowell. Shelby Steele. You want me to list some other people as well that had the right to speak?
Yeah, in the wake of the civil rights movement, you've got a few black conservatives, but for the longest time, blacks were not allowed their expression of freedom, and they were criminalized and they were hunted down. I mean, there's all sorts of oppressions that happen in this country, and we as white men especially have a kind of privilege, and that's why it's up to people like us who have that privilege to acknowledge the privilege and see that other people are extended the same kind of rights that we just had naturally by being born white and male.
So what we're saying is we should all feel guilty for the fact that we're white. And then we don't
guilt.
Give any anything. We give nothing to any other black that was around during the Revolutionary War or after the Revolutionary War, and the work was done by them. So none of them count, right? Is that what you're saying?
I don't know what you mean by none of them count. They're not given the kind of credence that the white founding fathers did. That's one of the knocks, actually, even against the musical Hamilton, which seems a little
right.
Off base,
so I guess the thing is, you want to say, well, I'm not allowed to express an opinion unless I'm on bended knee, but please forgive me for the fact that back in 1619, a slave was captured by another black man that then put that black man on a boat and was brought to the United States, at the time a young country where slavery was going on all over the world, and now I am not allowed to express an opinion because I'm guilty of being white. Is that,
you're not guilty, John. Yeah. You just need to acknowledge the advantages that you've had compared to other people. That's all.
Does that in any way take away from my opinion? So my opinion needs to be kept in context as a white person. Well, that is the exact same thing. But Tom, that's
Simone
the exact same thing.
Simone de Beauvoir's opinion, when she's talking to a bunch of poor people that she's trying to radicalize and trying to join her cause because I'm fighting for you, she has to understand that her life, the fact that she was an intellectual and allowed to pursue that, even though it was hard being a woman at that point in the 50s, that her status was allowed her to deal with it on a much grander philosophical level than the people that she was supposedly representing, the poor.
The thing I don't get is that you say to somebody, well, your opinion matters only to a certain extent because I will grant you how much credit you get because of the fact that you are this color or that color. Well, what is the difference between that and the way someone would express themselves in the 30s, 40s, 50s, or 60s that is black? Your opinion doesn't matter that much because of the color of your skin. It is the same thing that happens now, where we judge you, where you're coming from, and the skin color that you have, and the opinion and the value that we give you.
Just like you want contextualization for Confederate statues, that's contextualization. Whatever we say, there's a context for it. We need to acknowledge the context.
It's the thought expressed, not the color of the skin of the person expressing it.
And I say it's all context.
Okay, right back. It's It's in such a weird, weird year that it also reflected in the crime statistics. This is a piece of the New York Times. Basically, what they say is violent crime, which they list as assault, felony assault, rapes, muggings, I guess
robbery.
Robbery, right? That's down, but murder is up. And you can find a whole bunch of different people that look at this thing from a bunch of different ways. And the analysis seems to be that people, this is what I got, Tom, people were in their houses, stuck there, didn't walk around much, didn't get out much. Then when they do get out, they got a beef with somebody who lives down the street or something. And it's just more compartmentalized. It's closer. It's happening on blocks, one block or another block.
Yeah.
And then you have murder rates skyrocketing in New York City and Houston and Philadelphia and Baltimore and Washington and all those major cities.
Yeah, it's interesting because we do have the stats, and they say that it's almost unheard of to have violent crime go down but murder go up. And violent crime went down, you know, say 2%, so it wasn't like a huge amount, but murder went up 16% in the top 25 cities. So that's really a significant issue, and what is the cause? And that's, you mentioned the one that they suggest first, and that is it's increased domestic violence. They say that other kinds of crimes happen with people that you don't know. Murder often happens to be people that you do know. And so what's happening now during the pandemic and the lockdown, more people are spending their time, you know, among the people, their friends or people they live with. So domestic violence is way up. And when domestic violence is way up, then also something like murder is up. They also have a couple of other suggestions, which I think is I don't know, amusing is the wrong word, but there's a kind of an odd, ironic twist to this. They say that because COVID-19 has reduced the market for drugs, for illegal drugs, that puts stress on the drug markets and increases violence. So if you're used to making about X amount of money, and all of a sudden that X amount of money is dissipating because people are not out and about and not buying drugs as much, there's a more desperate fight for the few dollars that are out there. Mm-hmm. And they say, and this is where I think it's there's a bit of an irony there. These tensions might ease as lockdowns are relieved. Oh, good. We can bring back the drug market and people will start killing themselves. And then the third
killing
option.
Killing less. They kill less people.
Fewer people, yes.
Yeah.
As a result, just because the drug trade is now flourishing, and so you're not as desperate for every single dollar as you might. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing they suggest is if you have a loss of trust in law enforcement, then that makes people reluctant to contact police. Instead, they take the law into their own hands and figure, oh, you know, screw that. I'm not going to go through, you know, official channels. They actually suggest that one might be one of the reasons why people are murdering people at a higher rate, because they figure, well, the cops aren't going to be any help for me. So those are the three suggestions.
I don't think they ever believe the cops are going to be any help to them. It's generally, I don't care about the cops. I'm going to carry. They're not going to stop me. I'm going to settle this beef with somebody else.
You're right. I mean, that's a good
I don't know.
Plan.
Why now? Because why cops now? Are depolicing. They're not stopping. Yeah. They're not involved. They keep riding right on by or don't go to certain neighborhoods. So, and the part of it is such a small, tiny percentage of the overall population of that where this is occurring and the shootings that are going on. It is beefs being settled. And maybe it's the same sort of thing that happened when Prohibition hit. The number of murders went up precipitously because now all of a sudden you made alcohol illegal, and then you had people fighting over it. And when they when they got rid of that amendment, then it was the 19th or something, and all of a sudden the number of murders went down because you could get booze again. So
That's sort of like the drug market. By the way, murder is up in New York, it's up in Chicago, it's up in New Orleans, but they say, but just to keep this in perspective, it's not higher than it was 2 or 3 years ago in 2017 and 2016.
Yeah.
So it's just that if last year was a good year, this year is a bad year by comparison, but the overall arch doesn't seem to be as negative.
You know what I hate? I read all the way through the article, which takes like 6 or 7 pounds out of me, right? Having to read. And then I get all the way to the end, and then the guy goes, but, you know, you can't draw any conclusions on 1 year. I'm like, oh, well, thanks a lot.
There's
20 minutes of my life.
The reality is, we just don't know.
Yeah, thank
That's
you.
Literally the quote at the end of the article.
Thank you.